We've left off with Revelation chapter 6, verses 5 and 6. You may remember that in last week's class, we got through two of the first seals. The first seal is a rider on a white horse. Anyone remember how we identified this rider and the white horse?
Jesus.
All right, it's the Lord. What's he doing on this white horse? The Bible says he's going forth to conquer. Conquer what?
The world.
Okay. Or really sin, isn't it? That's the business that he's in, bringing people into that spiritual kingdom. So here he is. He's pictured as riding throughout the world, wanting to bring people into his spiritual kingdom, wanting them to receive the forgiveness of sins, being washed in his blood, as we see in the first chapter of Revelation. But as he's doing that, John then turns the attention to a second horse. It's a red horse. As he's out there working in the world, what do his people face? There's persecution. So even though the Lord's active, even though he's doing a great work, his people are going to face some difficulties in life. Sometimes that persecution is not to the point of death. Sometimes it is. This then brings us to Revelation chapter 6, verses 5 and 6, the third seal. And when he opened the third seal, I heard the living creature saying, "Come." And I saw, and behold, a black horse. And he that sat thereon had a balance in his hand. And I heard, as it were, a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A measure of wheat for a shilling, and three measures of barley for a shilling, and the oil and the wine hurt thou not." The color black. We sometimes use colors to symbolize various things. The color black, what does it often symbolize in our culture? Certainly would have been the same for these folks.
Death.
Black is associated with death.
Sin.
Sin would be another thing that we would associate with it. Grief. Mourning. Great difficulty, distress. As we look at Revelation 6, verses 5 and 6, this particular horse is associated with what form of distress?
Famine.
Now, we said with that first horse in Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, it's the Lord. But when we look at the second horse, as far as the persecution, it does not seem to me that we can point to a particular rider. That just seems to be a general description of persecution. The same would also seem to be true with this particular horse. There is no specific thing in mind. Let's break down some of the imagery. The rider has something in his hand. What is it? He's carrying a
scale.
All right, a balance. If you use the word scale, you just preempted me a bit, which was great. Thank you. He's carrying this scale. What's he got the scale out there for? What's he weighing? Scales weigh things. Wants to see how much his horse weighs?
Food.
All right, food. It's a time of famine. Time of scarcity. When you are weighing out food, what's that tell you about the economic time? It's very difficult. It's not like saying we want to go down and buy 5 pounds of sugar and we want to make sure that we get 5 pounds instead of four, but this was a very, very difficult time. John, as we said, has often pulled from the Old Testament as he goes through this book. In this particular case, the background might be Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 10. In this Old Testament reference, it's the same kind of thing. Food was so expensive that it is described as actually being weighed out. We have some specific information about the food. John said a measure of wheat for a shilling, three measures of barley for a shilling. This tells us what the people ate during regular times and during a time of economic hardship. If you were an average individual in this day and time, you would have eaten about a quart. That would be a measure of wheat every day. But if that was too expensive, or maybe you had several people in the family, what would you turn to? Wheat's too expensive, so you get barley. We see the same kind of thing today, do we not, with meat? Anybody priced beef lately? I was in the grocery store the other day. I never thought I'd see this, at least in my lifetime. A T-bone. I just happened to go through the meat section. Anybody priced a T-bone lately? $15 a piece for an average T-bone. So, I don't know what you spend as far as the meat budget in your household, but you got 4 or 5 people in the household. That's a pretty expensive meal. So, sometimes people say, well, hey, beef is up, so we're going to buy
hamburger.
Oh, okay, or maybe chicken. We're going to find the meat that's not as expensive as what's priced out of reach right now. So, that's not new. That same kind of thing was being done in this day and time. All right, how much money was being spent? How much for the items here?
Shilling.
A shilling. Anybody remember from another passage in the New Testament what a shilling was equal to?
A day's wage.
That's right. Matthew 20, verse 2. Matthew 22 tells us that a shilling was what people received for a day's wage on average. If a shilling is a day's wage and that's what you're having to spend down at the grocery store, what's that tell you about your life?
Poor.
Yeah. Very, very difficult time. You can probably manage to get by, but you're not going to have any extra. You're going to just be struggling. So the set of circumstances here does not seem to be life-threatening, but it does describe a terrible, terrible hardship. A little bit more about that in just a moment. Then we have a reference to two more items. Do not hurt, John says, the oil, and do not hurt the wine. A lot of different ideas about this, but the best that I can make out of it is that oil and wine seem to represent well. The picture seems to be, on the one hand, you've got some people who are suffering. They are involved in this famine, this situation where food is very, very difficult to get. But even though you have that, kind of like today, there would be some people that would say, hey, when it comes to beef, we've just been priced out of the market. You think Donald Trump has any reservations about putting T-bone on his table?
Probably not.
$15 a piece? Well, he'd prefer it to be $5, but still, it's not going to be, put a huge dent in his pocketbook. Do you think the world has always been like that? Well, you have some people who are struggling to make ends meet. They can barely put food on the table. There are some other people that say, grocery bill of $200, $500, $1,000, $5,000 a month for us, it's nothing. Sure, it's always been like that. This seems to be the idea here, that as God's people go throughout life, there is, I do not like the word inequity for a lot of reasons, but that's really sort of what we have here, that there are going to be these variations in life. One source described it this way. I think the quote is good. Oil and wine, which were luxuries and not necessities of life, would flow freely or cause even more exasperation as men saw them in abundance, but watched the slow trickle of grain into the hands of the famished. So as John describes this horse, this famine, this difficulty, which has happened at different times throughout the Christian era, it continues to happen today, he says, do not touch these things. You do have this inequity, and maybe also a way of saying that do not let this get out of control. God's people, are not going to starve to death, but they will have some times where they suffer great, great hardships, such as hunger and thirst. Some have also related this, and this could be true too, to the trade guilds in the first century. We talked before, these were sort of the first century labor unions. And today it's not as bad as it was, but if you want to work, what do you have to do as far as the first century? We've got our God over here. You want a job? You want food? You want to get along with our neighbors? What do? You come over and worship. We talked about the idolatry, the fornication, all the stuff that was going on there. So this could have been part of the background of that too. Don?
Because John was relating to things that happened locally that people could understand. My study Bible here says that the emperor 92, or say there was a great famine, mm-hmm. and he ordered the vineyards to be cut down to make more room for wheat, and there was a big backlash against it. He had to rescind the order.
Yeah.
So it might have been why he was using this.
That's true. There are a lot of commentators that pick up on that piece of historical information. So there are a lot of details like that that could be part of this. You also have, throughout time, various examples. Even in our day and time, we've talked about the Christians in Kenya, Africa. They're going through some difficulties with food right now. So, yes, throughout time, and as far as specifically linking these exact items with history, that would certainly be one example. Anybody else before I make a couple other quick comments? Okay. As I said, as we look at this seal, it reminds us that Christians do face some of life's hardships, but at the same time, we do want to point out that God does not forsake his people. The Hebrew writer talks about that in Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 through 6. So as we go through life, yes, there are going to be some difficult times. Yes, there are going to be some hardships. But at the same time, God says these will be bearable. When we look at this particular message, does it not stand in contrast to a lot of the denominational preaching that's done today? Serve God, send in your contribution, and what's he going to do with your life? You're going to be blessed. How do they define that blessing? It's going to be lots of money. Your problems are going to be erased. It's just like taking the eraser to the whiteboard, and God's going to wipe it all away and make it everything great. That's not what we find when we study the Christian life from the perspective of this seal. When people are struggling to put food in the belly, that's tough. That's one of life's greatest hardships. God says, if you're going to serve me, you may suffer persecution, that second horse. You may suffer economic hardship, you're having to go out and work for nothing but food, but still you persist until the end. The other point that I think I want to make here, then I'll give you a quote and then we'll look at Revelation chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. Christians do have to face the problems associated with several of the seals, but at the same time, they're not going to face the problems associated with these bowls of wrath that are coming in the book of Revelation. These things are going to be eternal problems for, that's not saying that in a good way. These things are going to be items that are faced by the unsaved, and they're not going to be able to deal with them in a good way. So we're going to have to take a hit one way or the other. God says, live the Christian life, I'll be with you, I'll help you through it, and you'll come to a time where all of these things cease. This quote, how tragic it is that those who are well-blessed materially think that they are God's favorites in the world. Often the biggest concern of those who fare sumptuously every day, Luke 16:19, is not how do we get the gospel to the poor, but when do we eat? We still have that same kind of attitude today among a lot of people. If folks have a lot of wealth, they think, oh, God's favorably inclined towards me. That's not necessarily true. Any other comments before we pick up with Revelation 6, 7, and 8? Trace? Okay, a couple things may be associated with that. Number one, it may be another description of saying that these hardships, they were going to be hard, but there were going to be some restrictions as well. It was not going to be like there was no food whatsoever. It was going to be difficult. It's a way of reinforcing that you're going to have to pay a lot for food, but you're still going to be able to get it. The other thing that I think is probably associated with that is that while people were struggling, trying to get the wheat, trying to get the barley, there were going to be people in another class, if you will, the wealthy class, that were going to say, oh, hey, we've got plenty. We don't like to pay the prices that we're having to pay. When you look at the prices that are described here, magnify your food costs by 10 to 12%. 10 times, 12 times. So if you go to the grocery store and you're spending $200 a week, move that up to $2,000. That's a pretty big increase for a lot of folks. Now, you can probably still make do. Maybe somebody's going to have to go out and get a second job. Maybe you're going to have to put the kids out in the field. But you can make do. But you are going to literally be scraping by. This is what John describes with the imagery here. Stan, did you have a thought? Okay. All right, let's pick up then with verses 7 and 8 in Revelation 6.
Hey, Brad.
I'm sorry.
Do you think that this could be maybe another persecution, a form of persecution?
It could be, especially with those trade guilds, with those labor unions. If you do not join yourself to our labor union, if you will, in the first century, then we're going to go ahead and limit what you can buy. There have been times, we think about some of the wars that we've seen, Vietnam, World War II, black market, you can get what you want. That was true for, I think it was World War II. Don't quote me on it. It may have been Vietnam. But women, stockings, pantyhose, couldn't buy them. But you go down to the black market, if they're $3 a piece downtown normally, if they're available, pay $25, for nylons. You can get them, but you're going to have to pay for them. We're going to charge you 10 times what you'd normally pay. So I'm not saying that Christians were buying things in the black market, but it may have been a neighbor who said, well, hey, I know that you're a Christian and, you've got some religious convictions and can't buy food, so we'll sell you bread. But we'll sell it at 2 or 3 times the markup. So however that all played out in the background that Don mentioned may have been associated with this as well. But throughout time, this is one of the things that people face. And sometimes it's for that reason today, sometimes for a different reason.
I know a dad who talked about that. Depression time, he went through it. And he said he worked for $1 a day, but there was stuff on the black market too that you paid a lot more for.
Yeah.
And that's what some people had to do, or like sugar. It was ration too, but only get so much sugar. Different things that you only buy a little bit of each.
Yeah.
So it was tough times.
Yeah, it is. And people have seen that throughout the world, including our country. Okay, verses 7 and 8. Let's pick up these, it'll kind of form the next paragraph. And we opened the fourth seal. I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come. And I saw, and behold, a pale horse. And he that sat upon him, his name was Death. And Hades, King James says, Hell. And Hades followed with him. And there was given unto them authority over the fourth part of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with death and by the wild beasts of the earth. Now, remember our seals. First seal, Jesus. Second seal, that red horse, persecution. Third seal, the black horse, this great famine that would affect people. Now we come to the fourth seal, the fourth horse. And the color of this horse is described as pale. All right. Any other words there that you may have seen or maybe a footnote?
Ashton, A-S-H-E-N,
horse. Okay. What's being described?
It's pale.
All right, it's pale. You go out and you see some crops, and this is a good year to illustrate this. You go out and you see the guy's corn crop that hasn't gotten any water. What's it look like?
Pale.
It looks sick, yellowish. It's got this pale color. It looks like it's ready to die. Maybe it is dead. You've got these blighted, these sickly plants. In this particular case, you have this color being associated with this image. You've got death on this horse. Literally true? Death ride a horse? No. It's a figure. It's a symbol. In this image, though, it's a little unusual. You've got this sickly color. We almost might think of it as the Grim Reaper. The Bible doesn't use that terminology, but we do sometimes in life hear that. You've got the Grim Reaper on this blighted, pale, yellowish, greenish color horse. And then something's behind him. What's behind him? Death. Well, no. What's behind death? Hades. As I said, some translations would use the word hell. It's of interest to me, we're not told exactly how it works, but if death is on the horse, how is Hades behind him? Is he running behind him? Maybe. Is he sitting on the same horse? Is he beside him in that way? Maybe. Is he on another horse? John simply doesn't tell us, but you do have death and Hades working hand in hand. And this will make a lot of sense, I think, as we look at some additional information. You've got death. He's there to collect souls. And Hades, the realm of the dead, why would it be associated with death? You've collected the soul. Now you need to put it somewhere. Just like if you've got a garage sale, get the money and you need to put it somewhere. Put it in your wallet, put it in your purse, put it in the bank. There needs to be a holding place for it. Well, this is also true when it comes to Hades. When we think about Luke 16, is this not the very picture that we have? Jesus talked about two men. There was a rich man and Lazarus. Both died. Jesus said they went where? They went to Hades. They went to the realm of the dead, the very place that is described here. Jesus said in Luke 16 that Hades has two different compartments. There is the compartment that Jesus described when he was on the cross, Luke 23, verse 43. He said, today, to the thief who showed remorse, repentance, he said, today you're going to be with me in where? We're going to paradise, not heaven. Acts 2 tells us that the Lord went to Hades. There is a section of Hades, the underworld, the place of departed spirits, that Jesus says is a pleasant place. It's like paradise. There's also a section of Hades, which is where the rich man in Luke 16 went. It would be the place where the unrighteous go, and that fellow, you may remember, is described as experiencing great, great pain. As we think about these seals and what they represent, let's go back to them again. Jesus, he's on the white horse conquering, but he's out there doing his work. As Christians live in the world, sometimes they suffer persecution. And they may also suffer, black horse,
famine,
hardships. Now we see as Christians live on the earth, they're also going to have to face
death.
That's true, isn't it? We've all had people die. We've had Christian friends die. We've had non-Christians die that we knew. And John reminds us that death is something that comes every single day. Anything you want to add or ask over what we've said so far? Julie? Catholic thought purgatory would be the idea that there's going to be, you go to this place and there has to be a purging. You have to, it would still be a holding place, but in this particular place, you're held there until you are purged from your sins. It would be like saying we've got, and this may not be an illustration that they would use or maybe even approve, but we would say, okay, we've got some dirty dishes in the sink. We are willing to put the dishes in the cupboard, but only after we've done what to them? They've got to be cleaned. Well, the same kind of idea. You can be in fellowship with God, but there has to be this cleaning, there has to be this purging process. So they would say, well, you've got to suffer for a while, or maybe some people on earth would have to pay some money to a priest, and after X number of dollars have been paid, then I think you would especially find this with Catholic thought, they would say, okay, whatever the price is to purchase the person, let's just say $5,000 for an illustration. After the $5,000 has been paid, up the, there was a cute little jingle about that, which I don't have offhand. You'll probably find it on the net. But something, as the coin drops, you know, the person flies out of purgatory. But it was really kind of a cute saying. But they made a ton of money on that. But that would be the basic gist of that. Trace, did you have a follow-up? They can say what they will. We know how it comes out.
Yeah.
So I just cut to the chase because that's what it boils down to. But yes, they would say you're going to pray them out of purgatory, but it's not.
Is that similar to the Jehovah's Witnesses? You know, Brian does a lot of genealogy, and they have more resources. Is that similar?
Okay, the Jehovah's Witnesses would hold to the idea of soul sleeping. When people die, even beyond that, you're dead. There is not going to be any kind of existence for you. So they would say that the wicked are going to be burned up at the end. It's going to be terrible. It's going to be awful. You would not want to experience that fate. But the idea of going to a state of suffering, they would say no. According to their view, that simply doesn't happen. Okay. All right. Next, let's go back here and develop the next section of what we have in these verses. John said this horse, death, had the power to kill. This is a section that has been a little perplexing to some folks because John says this horse had limited power. Death was able to kill how many folks?
A fourth.
A fourth part of the earth. Well, anybody want to take a stab at what that means?
A certain part of man, certain people.
Okay, that'll kind of head us down the road that we want to go initially. When we think about death, from what we see and what we know in this life, is it limited to a certain part of the earth? Is it literally limited to a fourth part of the earth?
No.
Death is a worldwide phenomenon, isn't it? There's no place, if there was a place on earth where death could not go, a lot of people would flock there. They would say, well, that's where I want to go because my life cannot be taken. We know that death is a universal thing. So when John says that death was given the power to kill people on a fourth part, a quarter of the earth, that cannot be a literal statement. We said repeatedly that John uses symbols, figures, and imagery throughout this book. So when we see the word or the number four here, we have to say, okay, we know it can't be literal. So it's got to symbolize something. If you will remember way back when, we talked about numbers. Remember what the number four is associated with in life and in the book of Revelation? Four. The world. We think about directions. North, south, east, west. This is probably the best illustration, but in the book of Revelation, four has the sense of man's world, the earth, our environment. If we bear that in mind, when John says that death has the ability to kill the fourth part of the world, it's a fraction. He uses that to say that death has partial control over God's people. Is that true? Think about man. We're basically composed of how many parts? We have our physical part, which it would be body and the thing that animates it, that spirit, if you will, which animals also have. And then we have the soul, the eternal spirit that continues with God. Two parts. All right, death can destroy which part?
Physical.
The physical part. Can it touch the spiritual part? No. In Matthew 10, verse 28, Jesus said, "Fear not them that are able to kill the body, but they're not able to kill the soul." So if death has the ability to just kill part of us, John says, I'm going to describe that how. Death has the ability to kill a fourth part of the world. And that's a figurative way of saying that death has the ability to take our physical life. That's true. And he can take that physical life all over the world. Now, a little bit later, and Don will take your hand in just a second. When we turn over to Revelation chapter 8, I believe it is. I didn't jot down the reference. But we're going to see that John uses another fraction. He talks about a third. When he talks about the third, if the fourth describes the physical part of man, If you just wanted to make a wild guess, the third is probably going to represent the spiritual part of man. So we'll say a little bit more about that when we get over there.
John talking about Christians only or the world in general?
The seals describe what happens to God's people. Now, some of what happens to God's people will also happen to people in the world. When we think about the famine, for example, there have been non-Christians who have had to experience great difficulty with food. So the primary focus, I would say, the main focus is going to be on Christians. It's also true here when it comes to death. But ultimately, it's also going to affect the non-Christian too. But here, and I'm glad you asked that question, here the emphasis is going to be on those who are children of God. Okay, a couple of the quick points that I want to make sure that we get through. It's been asked why John would talk about this fourth seal and relate it to death when he's already sort of hinted at death when you go back to the second seal. Remember that second seal, the red horse, John says, what happens? Let's go back and read it. Revelation 6:3, and when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, come. And another horse came forth, a red horse. And to him that sat thereon it was given the power to take peace from the earth, and that they should do what?
Slay
one another. Gave him a great sword. So that second seal, the second horse, the red horse had the ability to kill. Now John says there's death. It's also got the ability to kill. Why use this imagery of death back to back almost? Don?
So he's talking Christian against Christian here?
Well, I'm not so sure that we've got Christian against Christian. Let's deal with my question and then we can come back and touch on that. Why deal with death almost back to back? Here's what I think. Anybody ever been persecuted for the faith today? Anybody in this class, would you ever say that you've been persecuted? I don't mean they beat you half to death, but have we ever been persecuted?
Yes.
All right. We're still here, aren't we? So when we look at that second horse, persecution, a lot of the persecution is not going to involve death. It could, but that's not necessarily the case. But when we think about this fourth horse, unless the Lord comes, what's going to be true for everybody in the room? We are going to die. Death will have that power over us at some point. We are a walking corpse, if you will. Therese?
No, I was just... You asked a question.
You were going to respond. Okay. I don't think, Don, that we've got Christians killing one another back there. A reference to what happens to them as they live on the earth. That has happened, but typically, no. Okay. A couple of the quick points here. When we think about John's statement... As far as this seal, he says there at the end of verse 8, death and Hades followed with him. There was given over him authority, the fourth part of the earth to kill with, and here it is, sword, with famine, with death, and with evil beasts. If you will think back to what you may remember about the Old Testament, the first part of the Bible talks about God's four sore judgments. These are these four sore judgments. You can see them in places like Ezekiel 14, verse 21. When John goes back to the Old Testament, we see this time and time again, he will take an Old Testament passage, but with that Old Testament passage, he will associate with it a New Testament meaning. In other words, he will often use an Old Testament passage, the wording or the imagery, but he will use it in a different way. He puts his own spin or he makes his own use of it, if you will. And such is true here. When Ezekiel and other writers talked about God's four sore judgments, it was, you've been bad. Now you're going to be punished. Here are four of the big tools that God has in his tool chest to punish you. Well, here, as we think about these seals and Christians, is God using these kinds of things to punish his people? No. God says, though, you're living in a world where you're going to face persecution. You're living in a world where you're going to face things like famine. You're living in a world where you're going to face death. You're living in a world where you're not only going to face death. When people die, or when people think about death, ideally they would say, well, how do I want to leave this life? Anybody here hope they're hit by a train? Anybody here hope that they are, you know, involved in a serious car wreck and they linger for 2 weeks before, you know, they just have that kind of experience before they die? We don't want to die in that kind of way. We want to die in our sleep. We want to die where it's quick and painless, don't we? But God says with this image, I'm warning you, some people are going to die in what kind of way? If you are a Christian, there is no guarantee of an easy, peaceful death. You may die by wild beasts. You think that's ever happened to any of God's people? It did in Rome. When people would not renounce Christ, they'd sew them up in animal skins. Throw them out there to the hungry lions. Lions would rip them up. Or, if you think about Rome, they would throw them out in the arena. Let them face the tigers. Maybe not bears. But face those kinds of things. When we think about Christians, any of them ever die in the gladiatorial games? They did. A gruesome way to die. They had hot oil poured upon them. Some of them were covered with pitch and used as human torches. When you go back and you look at especially what ancient Rome did, what people today have done to God's people, it's awful. God says, you're going to die. And you may, as you experience this process, you may die in ways that we would not even want to imagine, let alone discuss. But in the midst of it all, God says, you be faithful. And I'm with you. I will see you through the process. I'll be on the other side there to welcome you, whatever happens in this life. So you stick with what's right. This is the message from the seals. You hang in there regardless.
Do you think the second century Christians had any trouble understanding this writing as we do today?
When you think about some of the study tools that we have, I use Bible commentaries as an example. These are by no means new. You can go back several hundred years and find that there were people who were trying to write some comments about God's Word. And you have very early some people who were known as the Church Fathers. Not literally, but they were influential people trying to write things from a Christian perspective. They would take the scriptures and they would write things, just as people today write bulletin articles, and we've got email, and all that's not new except the technology part of it. They didn't have computers and email back then. But you have people doing the same kinds of things. So you would have people who would have the scriptures. There were also these other writings that were circulating. So when you kind of look at what was taking place, Don, there were some tools that had sort of come from the first century with the scriptures that probably put those brethren in sort of the same category that we're in today. They would have been a generation removed from the apostles, but these things had continually been talked about, discussed. So you didn't have the apostles there to say, hey, what does this mean? But there would have been some people that would have been trying to sort through this, probably in some kind of Bible class environment, maybe preaching on it. So to do what we're doing today would have been something that was done at that time. And yes, I think some people were probably struggling with some things a little bit. But, you know, we're doing the same thing, but just with some different tools and really some better tools. Trace?
I think they would have been more familiar with the Old Testament than we tend to be.
Right.
We've gotten lazy in that study much, but if you read this last verse during Nebuchadnezzar's time, that's how they took over the city. They built siege walls. They wouldn't let food in. They went in and they killed them with the sword, and they left their bodies with wild beasts. I mean, so I think they understood because they were familiar with the Old Testament.
You have to interpret Revelation with some material outside the book. John intended for the material outside the book to be the Old Testament. If people are not familiar with the Old Testament, though, they're going to be using some other things. When you look at some of the modern interpreters, they do not use the Old Testament to interpret it. They use our current culture. We know about meteorites. When we start getting down to the in Revelation chapter 6, John's going to talk about the stars falling. Well, there have been some people who have said, oh yeah, these are meteorites. They're nuclear missiles. Well, I really doubt that John could conceive of a nuclear missile way back in his time, and God certainly didn't have that in mind. But that's taking the book, and it's looking through it. The lens is based on our technology. It's based on our culture. It's based on the nations today. If that's your lens that you're using to interpret this particular book, you can make it say all kinds of stuff. But when you go back and you look at the Old Testament, this is where John repeatedly draws his information from. If you do not go back and you refuse or fail to look at the symbols, it's going to be wrong as far as the interpretation. We can just about guarantee it. Okay, Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, introducing this material. John has, if we go back and offer a quick summary of this chapter, reminded us that Jesus is reigning over all people and all things. That does not exempt his people from persecution, verses 3 and 4, the hardship that we talked about in verses 5 and 6, or even dying a horrible death, verses 7 and 8. Now we are ready for seal number 5. It is in this seal that John says, I saw some souls, saw some people who had died. He pictures these people as being under the altar. He says they're there because they were slain for the word of God and the testimony which they held. It's interesting that the word held is expressed with the imperfect tense. Sometimes we would say, well, you know, he was faithful, or he didn't faint, he didn't fall in this situation. But the next time that comes up, he did faint, he did fall. It didn't work the second time. So when John says they held the testimony, it describes continuous action. Remember what we said before? The book, you stay faithful regardless of what your circumstances are. You stay committed to God. These people made this choice. John said they made this choice, and now the picture is that they were blessed. When we look at the preceding seals, up to this point we've had four seals. Who introduces, or what introduces each of the seals? There is this living creature, which, as we said in previous classes, appears to be a cherubim. Only four of these creatures are described in the book of Revelation. Maybe there are more, maybe not. But now, as we deal with the last three seals, these creatures sort of fade from the distance. They are not introducing these seals. We do have, with the last three seals, what we might call a change of scenery. The seals still remind us that God has set some things in motion. These things are sealed. They're not going to be changed. They are going to continue. Verses 9 through 11 of Revelation 6. And when he opened the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of them that had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a great voice, saying, How long, O Master, the holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And there was given them to each one a white robe. And it was said unto them that they should yet rest for a little time, until their fellow servants also and their brethren, who should be killed even as they were, should have fulfilled their course. Like many of the other verses in the book of Revelation, we find here a contrast. On the one, we have the people. I think that just describes, you know, everybody? Bessie, again?
You're speaking of the Christians?
No, the earth dwellers in the book of Revelation is going to describe a specific group of folks, but it's going to describe the unrighteous, those who dwell on the earth. In contrast to who? Those who are raised up, those who are trying to live the Christian life. We're going to see this expression again and again throughout the book. We'll see it in chapters 8, 11, 13, and chapter 17. With this fifth seal, John shows that the Christian era, as it continues to pass, some are going to be so committed to God that they do die for the faith. Verse 9. There were people under the Old Testament who certainly had lived in this kind of way. Now, as we look at the New Testament era, we find that this same type of commitment continues to exist among God's people. Now, if you have a Christian who's going through a very difficult time, he's thinking, well, or she's thinking, life is very, very difficult. It seems like the more I try to serve God, the worse life gets. At some point, do we not find Christians ask themselves, is it worth it? You think any Christian asks himself that today? Is it really worth it? I've been trying to live a Christian life for 5 years, 10 years, 25 years. I'm not sure it's worth it any longer. John may not ask that question, but he does show the answer to that question is yes in these verses. The elder described in this verse describes being before God's throne, Revelation chapter 8, verse 3, being in his presence. So the implied answer is it worth it? Yes. You suffer these things, even to the point of dying, in a very hostile way, a very unfortunate way, you're going to enter into the presence of God. When we think about an altar, for us, people, you know, oh, we have an altar, we, you know, go to the altar call. Sometimes people will use that terminology. It's not Bible terminology. But to talk about an altar, for us, the altar is not that big of a deal. But if we had lived in the first century, whether we were a Jew or a Gentile, and certainly before that, was the altar a big deal for folks? It was. Let's go back and pick up an Old Testament reference. This is about as far as we're going to get today. Leviticus chapter 4, verse 7, and see what this verse tells us.